I'm Lewis Ludlow, and you're listening to Cherry Jam.
Hello and welcome to Series 5, Episode 9 of Cherry Jam. Myself, Ab Price, Jim Harley, Lawrence Landry. Things may be changing at Gloucester Rugby. A hard-fought win up at Newcastle on a cold, wet, windy Friday night. Our first away win in 364 days in the Gallagher Premiership.
It's quite impressive.
Wow. Nearly as impressive as England's performance against South Africa in the World Cup semi-final, only to be cruelly defeated in the last 2 minutes. The bastards gave us hope.
That was good.
We'll be chatting about that, and we'll also be talking about the other semi-final and more general rugby stuff, and the next couple of weeks for Gloucester, and where we hopefully can expect to see us before we have the European break at the beginning of December. We'll start, though, with Friday night. And as I said, a win. I mean, it was a win. Although the last 5 minutes, again, once again, we were hanging on a bit. Against Newcastle, which we traditionally performed poorly at. Loz, I'll start with you. I think it was quite funny, actually, reading the group chat while I was watching in the final, that second half. I'm not saying we're a depressive bunch and might be slightly cynical, but you could see the car crash waiting to happen, but somehow we managed to veer off at the end and save ourselves. What was your overall view of the game?
I do believe I put, here we go.
Yeah, it literally was.
we gave away a stupid penalty on about 65 minutes, and I text, here we go, and so it begins, or something along those lines.
Yeah.
Words to that effect, because you could just see it. And Jesus Christ. You want to be positive. You think, right, we went top of the league. We got a win away from home in a place we, over the years, no matter what sort of team we've put together, whether it's been a team capable of finishing top of the league or towards the bottom of the league or somewhere in between, we have struggled that no matter what. And there's a massive positive is at 80 plus minutes when the referee blew his final whistle, we had more points than them. I think any split second up until that moment when Lewis Ludlow got his hands on the ball, we were concerned that it would be a yet another loss snatched from the jaws of victory. We were terrible in that last 20 minutes. I don't know what went on for us. As good as we were in the first 60, I don't know what happened to us. I really despair. I genuinely do. And there's two ways you can look at it. It's funny because I was talking to my father earlier today about this, and he was saying about it as well. And you want to be like, oh, the mentality of the team to grind out that victory in the end. You think, brilliant, congratulations. You want to be really positive about it. But no self-respecting team who wants to be challenging at the top end of the table would ever put themselves in that position and being 18-0 up with 60 minutes gone. They would have continued to have carried on how they were, ground out the victory. And the thing which worries me the most is it was a... We're looking to move away from the boring tactics of last season where we're kicking. Yet, if ever there was a weather conditions which wanted us to just kick everything away and go back to that boring way of playing, it was Friday night. And our players didn't seem to know. At some stages in that game, it was like, oh, should we go from here? And I've always been a big fan of playing what's in front of you. And if it's on, it's on. But there's an argument that it's never truly on in that weather conditions, especially if you've got the wind behind you. Because, yeah. You know, certainly in your own half, especially if you're in your own half, as far as I'm concerned, because it was atrocious up there. And, we got messages from Snowy during the day, who's in Manchester, asking if the game was going ahead. And I was like, checking Twitter or X or whatever you want to call it, sort of on a half-hour basis as to whether the game had been called off or not. Because you're hearing all these reports of what it's like in Scotland. You hear it, then Snowy's telling you in Rossendale, somewhere in between the two, it's terrible. And you're just wondering how this game might go ahead. And then you see Gloucester put up that video going, oh, looks lovely up here, or whatever it said. And you're thinking, well, this game probably isn't going ahead. And it does. And then we've played really well for 60 minutes because we controlled the game. We didn't give them much. We were fairly... We did make, obviously, some mistakes, and they didn't capitalize on them. They were a poor team and showed why they're probably going to be around the bottom three, certainly, if not bottom. But overall, I thought we had good control on the match for 60 minutes, and then we just pressed the self-destruct button.
Yeah, I mean, on that, I mean, I do agree. So first 60 minutes, absolutely played textbook rugby for the conditions. Jim, we'll come on to the last 20 and some of the reasons why it went wrong in a minute. But Jim, just let's focus on the positives to start with. I thought the way that we basically just made Newcastle make mistakes was really encouraging to see. And then actually, for the most part, for the first 30 minutes, capitalising on them.
Yeah, I mean, those sorts of conditions, and I really don't think, certainly my little tablet screen that I was watching on, kind of was a particularly good representation. I think some of the camera lenses are quite good at cutting through the rain, makes it look a lot better than it actually is. And then you see some sort of close-up stills and you go, oh, yeah. So it's those sorts of conditions that you're better off not having the ball.
Yeah.
Which is actually like some of the rugby that we've been playing for the last year or two anyway. But actually, this was the time to do it. So yeah, sort of the kicking game and the pressure in defence seemed to work really well. And I was, yeah, really quite impressed with the way we managed the game for the first hour.
And in terms of the players themselves, I thought, you know, Varney, I thought, was really good. Made that, you know, he had a tough World Cup. Let's be honest, yeah. he had a difficult World Cup, and I thought having to come on really early in the day last week and then playing the majority again on Friday. Yeah,
he played 70 minutes, didn't he?
So yeah, he's done. He did really, really well again. I thought his distribution from nine was good. I thought his kicking was excellent. I mean, it was his box kick that led to one of the weirdest tries probably of the weekend, which was a steepling up and under box kick, which the Newcastle fullback just kind of
after
went...
After you. After you.
And then Jake Morris went, oh, thanks, cheers, boys. And, you know, I thought the pack in particular, I mean, Zach Mercer again, just instant. We've seen him a couple of times now, but he's just different class. He's so difficult to get down, to bring down, makes yards. Yeah, it was definitely, by the way, it was definitely a no-arms tackle in the second half. It happens. But he doesn't strike me as that's a play. That's something he'll be doing on a regular basis. I think he just got it slightly wrong. But I thought, yeah, you know, overall, the first 60 minutes, again, really good. But Loz, you mentioned last 20 minutes, it really did go to pot very quickly.
Yeah, there was a noticeable drop-off, actually, once Varney went off. Chapman, I don't mean to say nasty against him, because I think he's a good player, but he just looked out of his depth almost. So whether he's carrying...
Yeah, whether he's carrying
said about
knock.
Him going off from last week.
Well, McGuigan got the yellow card, didn't he?
Yeah, I mean...
Do you think that kind of gave...
Yeah, but we'd already got them back into the game before that yellow card. We'd given them hope at that stage.
Yeah, we were making silly mistakes, weren't we?
We got them into that position where then McGuigan gave away the yellow card. And I don't think anyone can complain about the yellow card.
No.
And fair play to Radwan as well. He got that ball which was just bouncing around all over the place. And we've seen before, and we've even commented on it amongst ourselves about how dangerous that when the ball starts bouncing around like that, how dangerous it is for a defensive team to be able to deal with that. And he's got electric footwork, and if he can keep his balance in that sort of weather, he's always going to be difficult to put down, because it's obviously soaking wet anyway from the rain, which makes him like a bar of soap. And then he's got that pace and that electric footwork, and I still think we didn't particularly make our best efforts at tackling him, but you know, it is what it is at the end of the day, and I don't want to come across as too harsh. As I said, with Chapman, I don't want to be picking him out or singling him out. I'm just saying he didn't seem to have his best game, whether it's because he's had that knock or what. But and the other one who also, well, I think I made a comment on, was Seb Atkinson. He didn't have his finest 10 or 15 minutes when he came on for McGregor. Seb Blake, not Seb Atkinson. Apologies, yeah. I don't think he had his best. I personally feel, because I've seen him a couple of times when he's come off the bench, he hasn't been great. I think he's one of those players that you need to start. He struggles to find the pace of the game if he comes off the bench, potentially.
Yeah, he's still young, though, isn't he? I think
he's, oh, he's
young.
Very young.
But that's a really good point,
I don't want it to come across as me being critical. I just think he's one of those that if you're going to play Seb Blake, start him.
Yeah, but no, it's a good point. And I think it's, you know, we forget he is a young lad and he played so much last year and did an incredible job filling in when we had literally no hookers, pretty much.
Oh, he was superb last year.
And I think, yeah, you're right in saying that probably is the development of his game is going to be, how does he do that? How does he pick up the pace of a game? Make sure he gets those arrows firing straight away. Because generally, you know, he's going to be coming in. It's his job really to lock it down, to make sure that the lineout's secured. When you know the last 20 minutes or 10 minutes of a game, they're going to be going hard at our lineouts, particularly if it's a close game.
Well, yeah, contrast that to how Val was.
Yeah.
Val hasn't played he's played next to nothing in, obviously he was away with England camp. He's played next to nothing since last season.
Mm.
And he was in, it was as though he'd been playing every week.
Yeah, I mean, different. Again, came on, made a huge impact straight away, that scrum at the end. But that was, I have to be honest, the scrum was a real big bonus. And again, it was last week, really, wasn't it? Where the work that Trevor Woodman has been doing, I think George Givington referenced it after the game, that the scrum is now becoming a bit of a weapon, when a couple of years ago it was a really severe weakness. And we've got props now, both sides of the scrum, who are not only capable but also destructive.
And they're not just scrummagers. That, you know, I mean, Val is ridiculously good in the loose, isn't he?
Yeah.
So it's having players that you can rely on to get good go forward ball off our scrum and put opposition scrum under a little bit of pressure, so maybe they don't get quite such fantastic ball, and then, you know, they make their tackles and make their turnovers and pick and goes and what have you outside of the scrum as well.
Yeah,
class. It would be someone like Kirill. I appreciate he wasn't involved last night. Friday night, but he's just a tackling machine as well as his scrummaging, isn't he?
Yeah, and this is the thing, you know, these guys as everyone knows, my misgivings of Kirill when he joined in terms of his scrummaging technique.
Oh, what was that?
Well, yeah, but he's definitely someone who has impressed me every time he's played. He's significantly improved on what we all thought we were going to get out of him. And now we've got Fraser back. I thought that was a really, really big performance by Fraser on Friday night. I mean, he had a good game against Quinns, but that was a big game, big performance, and it's great to have him back because he's not only a great player, he's a big character within the dressing room.
He's played a lot. I know he's only played this match and the previous match, but it's a lot of rugby to have played in a short space of time for someone who's been out for as long as he was.
Yeah. And you know, there's some what's really encouraging, though, if you look at that squad on Friday night, and I think Snowy referenced it in our comments about the fact that, you know, the rotation of players, and is there a danger that we get caught out by not picking the best 15 and all the rest of it. I felt that what's encouraging is, a bit like a few years ago when we finished fourth, that we do seem to have a bit more depth now because we've given these players an opportunity to play.
Yeah. There's nothing worse than expecting someone that hasn't played. I mean, obviously, you just mentioned we've had a couple of players that haven't played a lot and were fantastic. But I think there's nothing worse than having to throw someone without match experience into the starting lineup because of injuries or suspensions and stuff.
Yeah.
And they don't perform, you know, to the standards that they would expect of themselves because they're rusty, and it's a real fine balance, isn't it? And obviously, you know, two from two, we seem to be going all right. I think we do need to settle down and work out what our first 15 is.
Yeah, I mean, obviously,
if we can swap out a couple of those every game so that we get good core consistency, but everyone's getting a little bit of game time, bit of rest, recovery, then, you know, hopefully we won't have the same issue as we had last year where we second half of the season a complete dog shit.
I mean, to be fair to it, a couple of, I just want to point out a few couple of really key players, I thought, and stepping up. So you've got Alex Hurl coming in after 22 minutes for Lloyd Evans. And I thought I had a good game. We've already kind of mentioned that Val came on and did well. What was, I mean, to be fair, the one player I think has really impressed hugely, and it was, you can clearly see the faith that George Skivington has in him is obviously Arthur Clarke, in that now, when we get Matias Alemano back from Argentina for the World Cup, I assume he will slot in now in terms, but having that extra player in the second row who, I don't feel we're losing anything at all. In fact, I think we might be gaining something because of his.
We did question when Alex Craig was released because we lost that. I know he's injured so much last season and season before, but we did. Well, certainly I questioned because we were losing a youngish player who was a Scotland international.
Yeah.
About replacing that sort of quality because they hadn't signed anyone. And basically, obviously, the club were aware of Arthur Clarke, and his coming into the team is really, well, it's just been unbelievable how he stepped up, actually.
Yeah, and led the team in games. I mean, he was captain for the Barbados game.
Exactly.
You know, that's a huge accolade to have, and I tweeted out on Friday night. Look. Don't get me wrong, last 20 minutes was disappointing from a performance point of view. And we all could see that car crash coming, and it was, as I said, you know, swerving off just to avoid it at the end. But a win is a win, particularly in those conditions. And at times, last season, we would have killed for one of those wins. And I think I totally get, Loz is absolutely right. There were times that last 20 minutes, which it would throw concerns if there is a situation later in the season where we need to really grind out a win, because actually you could almost see the players kind of rabbits in the headlight stuff. But the fact we did come through it, and that's two games in a row, really, we've managed to grind out wins. And I'm not saying we're going to be challenging for the title, but to get into the top four, to get into Champions Cup, you need to win these games. We've got a great opportunity next Friday against Saracens when they're severely weakened. They lost again, this time to Bath at home this weekend. And we've kind of touched on the side that we picked. And this isn't to denigrate anybody, but you would expect with the likes of Louis Rees-Sammet back. I mean, there were hints that he was a slight knock, but you'd think he should be available. You know, you would expect probably that we're going to play about as strong a side as you could possibly play at this point.
You hope so, wouldn't
I think. I think the fact that it's a home game, the fact that it's against Saracens,
yeah,
I think it's really, really important. I mean, obviously every game is important, every home game is important, but I think mentally, even though we all know it's a depleted Saracens team,
yeah,
I think to play well in that and win. Because obviously the last two games, you would say we didn't control the game from start to finish. So if we can really control the game, come out with a good victory. I know it's, you know, today that Exeter, who obviously thumped Saracens on the opening weekend, they got beaten by Quins.
Yeah.
So that, you know, I mean, I didn't see what the squad was, but I'm assuming they're going to be somewhere similar to the previous week. So you're sort of thinking, well, That says that we are currently, with the squad that we've got, one of the strongest sides in the league. I know it's incredibly early days. So, you know, I think Snowy alluded to it last week. You know, this period, these few weeks, while the likes of Saracens are going to be struggling, we absolutely need to kick on and give ourselves a bit of a buffer, because we're going to be losing games later in the season against, you know, quality opposition when we've got, especially if we've got a few injuries.
For as much as I've been negative about Gloucester. I'm sorry for that.
You can only,
I was just so disappointed with the way we let them back in, but yeah. You can only beat what's in front of you.
Yeah.
Which we did. And not just that, it's a game we had lost last season, as you touched on, and we won it. Yeah. And as Jim said, we are looking like one of the better sides. We could, there hasn't been a time where we would not have taken 14 points from 15 available at the start of the season, which is what we're potentially on for, because I don't care what Saris side is out there. To beat them, you usually have to score four tries to win.
Yeah.
I don't think you win matches.
And I think Saris, we would have scored four tries up in Newcastle, even on an away game, if the weather wasn't biblical.
The weather had been different, we'd have won that at a canter, because Newcastle are a poor side, and I don't think we are. We've seen that we weren't... Let's not get too carried away. Snowy is the perfect person for this, because he always turns around and says, one win doesn't make us world beaters, and one defeat doesn't make us the worst team in the world. But we've seen a bit of a growth in our game through pre-season. It's not pre-season, is it? But the way the team as a squad, sorry, the squad as a whole are trying to play through the Premiership Cup matches.
Yeah.
That has shown a great improvement on how we were playing last season. Just the mentality of the players is to actually play more rugby rather than kick the ball away. The weather was a freak this weekend. It caused us to have to revert back to type, presumably. It was not anything other than the weather, I think, caused us to go down that route. And I'm looking forward to how we take on Saracens, because traditionally that was always a game where you would go revert back to that box kick, and try and force them to make the errors, because that's what they like to do to you.
Yeah, Exeter ripped them apart, and they played really, really attacking.
They played
rugby.
Some proper good rugby as well, doing.
And
that.
I think that might be the way to go. Certainly at the moment, while they're depleted. Just a little note, actually, on as an aside, I suppose, on the other weekend's results. A big win for Bath. Fair play to them. You know, we don't like it when they win, but. It was a good win for them away to Saris. And then, excuse me, the other results, as I mentioned, Bristol got a good win away to Northampton, and Sale beat Leicester. It would have been weird, though, wouldn't it? Obviously, Quinns beat Exeter, but it was quite close until the last seconds, where Quinns got a penalty to secure the points and actually deny Exeter a losing bonus point. But we were almost on for a clean sweep of away victories, which I'm not sure has ever happened in the Premiership before. So that would have been interesting. And then one other final thing, massive, massive well done to any Gloucester fans who travelled up to that game on Friday night, because that was just ridiculous. I mean, I think there were people who might have travelled up on the Thursday night and stayed over, but there were definitely...
Even still.
I mean, there were a good 100 or 200 Gloucester fans up there, and massive credit to you. I know that the club at George Skivington mentioned after the game, and I think the players definitely they did a bit of a big thank you lap to labour the point. We've all been there. We've all gone up to Newcastle and watched games up there. It's a long way to go. It's remarkably a long way to go, and it's bad enough on a Saturday afternoon or a Sunday afternoon when you've got time to get up there and stuff, but on a Friday night where it's a 6 o'clock kickoff,
well, it's normally 7:45 as well.
Yeah, so it's normally 7:45 kickoff.
Well, it's normally on a Sunday as well, isn't it?
It's a Friday night or a Sunday night, Jim. Generally, yeah. You're right. It's very rarely on a Saturday for obvious reasons up in Newcastle. But you know, I thought fair play. That's a big effort by those Gloucester supporters, and I think massive props to you guys. Right, we're going to pause. We're going to talk about the semi-finals of the World Cup. We will start with the Argentina-New Zealand game and then come on to England-South Africa.
This is George Skivington. You're listening to the Cherry Jam podcast.
Right, Friday night while Gloucester were playing, or after Gloucester were playing, I should say, was the first semi-final of the World Cup. Between Argentina and New Zealand, and to suggest it was one-sided would be unfair to a one-sided match. It was a walkover. New Zealand hammered Argentina and really probably left a good 20 points out there. It wasn't a great look for the tournament, and it definitely wasn't a good look for an Argentina side that looked mainly just happy to be there. But do you think New Zealand learned anything from that game? A genuine question to both of you.
I don't think they care. They're in the World Cup final.
No, but you'd want to have some things that you learn probably as
don't
well.
Think so. They learned lessons. I think they lost to South Africa before the World Cup. They lost to France the first game of the World Cup. They've learned enough. They're in the World Cup final that they won't give a shit.
They will be more than grateful that they had an easy semi-final and go into the final, you know, fighting fit. Whereas South Africa,
they're going to be hanging at their asses, aren't they?
Yeah. We absolutely, yeah, we'll talk about that in a minute. But I think it's really important. And obviously, last World Cup proved that we put in a monumental performance against New Zealand and then we just didn't have enough left in the tank for South Africa. I think it's quite important that you have a bit left in the locker after a big game, mentally as well as physically. And I think maybe New Zealand have got plenty left.
Yeah, well, you do have to wonder about South Africa having gone through two games, don't you? Gatland turned around and made the comment in the last World Cup with England. He said that the win against New Zealand was our final. And it was such a big performance, such a convincing win against New Zealand. Instead of going in absolutely brimming with confidence, we went into a game where we were smashed up front and physically outdone, and it looked the proverbial one game too far. You do wonder now, with South Africa having had two of these matches on the trot now, because fair play to England, they didn't have to take it to it. Whether we like how they played or not, they didn't have to take it to them. And I appreciate we're not getting onto the England game just at the moment. We're talking about New Zealand. Look, there's not too much to talk about on the New Zealand game.
They gave them
an absolute shellacking. But my point I'm trying to say, Ed, is South Africa have been through two of these games which have been exceedingly close, under massive amount of pressure. It's taken a lot out of them, both mentally and physically. I've never known a team empty their bloody bench after 55 minutes or whatever it was.
No.
And they were lucky they didn't have an injury after that.
We mentioned that. We will come on. I just want
yeah,
to
sorry,
just,
yeah.
Go, no, no, go. Actually fine. You're right to mention it, and it's a good comparison to make, and we will go into a bit more depth in a second. But the New Zealand, what I thought was impressive, I mean, you know, regardless of the fact that Argentina were very timid, but New Zealand didn't let them play, and New Zealand just kept playing. They just kept going, which is very impressive, particularly when you get to that level. You sometimes will be thinking, right, we're in the final now, let's hold stuff back.
And New Zealand are notoriously ruthless like that, aren't they? And I think Argentina have been poor on the build-up to the World Cup. They were poor during the pool stage. They benefited, just as England have, with the draw. And they came up against one of the top sides and got right royally found out. And at the same time, New Zealand show no mercy. And I think the way you say, when the game is won, when you're 30 points up, you go, right, well, let's just turn the dial down and take it a little bit steady. But that's when teams pick up injuries. That's when things go wrong. That's when you get blasé and kind of, You don't run the systems like you should, and I think it's quite telling that it doesn't matter whether it's the opening minute, the 79th minute, whether they're winning by 20, winning by 100, or whether they're a few points down, they play the same. Maybe game plan slightly differently, but like the amount of effort they put in is 100%. They don't pull any punches, and
one of the great
because they always do that.
is always the fact that none of them are greedy. None of them seems to go himself and butcher a try, or very rarely does that happen.
So there was one right at the end where Will Jordan would be killing him.
I appreciate that. But that's a rarity in all fairness. The majority of the time, it's the greater good is always there with New Zealand rugby, and that's, I think, is probably why they score more tries from chances than what most sides do, no matter how good they are, because the All Blacks, it's always been the greater good. It's always been for the jersey and the greater good rather than the self.
Every time you say the greater good, all I can think of is the greater good. Sorry. Yeah. Anyway.
But it's absolutely true. And I think that's something that all rugby should strive for, really. It's every try is a team try. And you know, that there are those guys that rarely score, and that doesn't mean that they're any less important in the grand scheme of, you know, winning ball. And
it's a great advert for how you want to teach your kids, doesn't it, Jim? You know, you do the the coaching to the youngsters. It's...
Absolutely. You know, I've got one. I think it's only one of my guys that's never scored. You know, and he's playing at prop. He's playing a little bit of hooker, and I'm like, you might get a try now, because if you're the back of the rolling ball, you'll be all right. And then someone else will go hooker, and he'll go in at prop, and the hooker will score. But it's I make a point of applauding the player that made the tackle, you know, that resulted in the turnover, or the kid that popped the ball off the ground or did something that then resulted in a try, rather than the try scorer, because actually scoring the try is the easy bit.
Yeah, I mean, I just want to just sort of finish on one aspect of New Zealand which I thought was interesting, probably what they have gained, is obviously Talia got left out in the quarterfinals because he broke his curfew or something, and had an absolute stormer against Argentina. And if you want to,
sorry, boys, I'll put it right.
Yeah, and I felt that's a really good example of the culture that they're trying to maybe bring back into the New Zealand rugby. Because I think, you know, the old sort of maxim that they had for a long time was no dickheads, and I think they did go away from that maxim a little bit. There were a few quite high profile incidents, and there's some of those players are still within the squad, but. You know, that was a really strong message left to the squad and to Talera himself, obviously, to leave you out in the quarterfinal, which, you know, let's be honest, it was a tight game against Ireland. It was a 50-50 toss of a coin, could have gone either way, and that could have been his last ever World Cup game. So
whoever was playing, let's put it this way, in the Ireland-New Zealand game, knew their semi-final, if they got there, would not be as difficult as what match they were playing then.
No, and one thing actually, just a quick touch on this. There was a lot of stuff on Twitter, mainly from Irish Twitter, about how awful that game was for rugby union and as a showpiece and all this nonsense. And I'm like,
hey,
yeah, I know. Well,
they have been saying the same if they beat the All Blacks and then put 50 points on Ireland?
This is my exact point, is the saltiness of some of the Celtics around this World Cup and the draw. Yeah, we all recognise the draw was flawed, right? No one is gonna get away from the fact they drew that draw 2 years too early, right? Absolutely fine. We all recognise it. But unfortunately, you all played into you all knew the rules and you all knew the whole system. It's not World Rugby's fault that Ireland keep bombing out in quarterfinals and Scotland got knocked out in a group where they were playing Japan. That's not World Rugby's fault. If you want to get a better draw, be better at the World Cup. Obviously, they're going to change it for the next one, and it's going to be slightly different based on world rankings. Well, tough shit. If you have your next 12 months is a bit crap, Scotland, isn't it? So you've got to make sure you're in the top eight, and you get or top four, and you get a good draw in the World Cup. That's how it's going to work.
I'm not buying any of this. I'm sorry, but the third, fourth playoff is between two teams from the same group. That must have surely been the toughest group for them to get out and get to that standard and both get to the semi-finals. I'm sorry. Whatever anyone else says, England were in a tough group. I don't care.
Yeah, third and fourth best team in the world in that group.
Exactly. So anyone else, you know, Sorry, I've looked really close at the World at the World Cup, and I still can't see France, Scotland, Ireland, or Wales on there.
That's true. Yeah, another 4 years, boys. What, four more years?
I did laugh at a meme I got the other day. It said there was an Irishman, a Scotsman, and a Welshman in the pub. Normally there'd be an Englishman there, but you're still in France.
Yep. I mean, look, we'll move on to the England now, and I have to be honest.
And we're still in France, by the way, even though we lost. Just
yeah, it's true. We're still there. There was a little bit of me who was kind of hoping that by about 8:30 on Saturday, I could kind of just sort of settle back and just watch South Africa win. That was just because I thought it's going to be better for my blood pressure. It's going to be better for my heart, and possibly is not going to result in...
You do, and I've taught some shit at times.
Being
I'm sorry.
My heart was racing.
What a load of crap.
So I got an alert just before the fateful scrum that my heart rate had got to 120 beats per minute over a 10-minute period without doing any exercise. I checked, and the highest heart rate, and I can think it was when Farrell got his drop goal, was 134. And I was watching a game of sport on television. The bastards gave me hope and then cruelly took it away. And we'll go on to let's just start off with the game itself. We all said that the deaf thing was, we all said in the week before, and it would be kind of well publicized, that the only way England could really compete with South Africa was playing a really strict kicking game and limiting South Africa ball. And they did, and South Africa had no answer for it for 65 minutes, basically.
It was quite funny to see that. Because it was almost like, do you know what? We've always turned around and said, what I mean by we've always turned around and said, because I appreciate I don't come on the podcast very often, but I mean in our group chat, how South Africa basically play by that laptop that comes up in front of them and it tells them what they have to do next. I think Snowy referred to it as their AI.
AI coaching team.
Yeah, the AI coaching team. And they send these sort of like
Semaphore.
Semaphore, that's it. Sorry, not sober for it. Send them to sleep, isn't it? Semaphore.
No, it's just England's game plan. Anyway, move on.
Yeah. Semaphoric signals into the match as to what to do next. And they couldn't come up with a solution because, the computer says no. It was almost like that, the way they were. And their solution was, right, we'll empty the bench. Don't let some of these lads could come up with something. And fair play, they did. But it was quite funny for a very long period of time. And then the referee had decisions on the scrums.
Well, yeah, we'll come on to the scrums in a second. But you're right. It was interesting to watch the South African bench and South African coaching team having a massive panic attack.
They were not expecting to be down. You know, the score at half time was good. And they were concerned, and like Lauren said, like emptying the bench. I mean, that was incredibly high risk. I mean, the bench, they've run a very high risk bench in the past, haven't they, with their splits,
7-1 splits and stuff. Yeah,
and you think, goodness me, you know, an early injury, and then you're really, really going to be in trouble. But they took a gamble, and yeah, scrum. You know, I think we called it previously that we didn't think we had the best scrum in the world. And that was the difference in the end, wasn't it? We just...
Yeah. It's credit to Dan Cole.
I was going
to
say, thank you, Loz.
Up until, I think, when he... The scrum before he came off.
Yeah.
He had... When it came to scrummaging, he had a superb game.
But he doesn't do anything else.
No, he doesn't.
But...
He doesn't, which is unusual how he gets selected for England, given the fact that someone like Val, who has this all-court game, what they want, why he never got picked. And we've had players who haven't got picked for England before because we've been told, oh, well, all he can do is scrummage.
Mm-hmm. Well, so I would agree entirely. Let's be honest. We all thought this. When Dan Cole got selected, we're like, why? Right? But when you've got a game plan which is simple and as restrictive as it was, so I think... Tuolangi maybe caught at that two touches of the ball
There were a lot of players that were, had an incredibly
Johnny
quiet
May
game.
Touched the ball other than to try and do a tap back.
Tap it,
but
yeah.
My God, didn't he do well at it?
Oh,
well, but
he's one of the best. So, that's the thing. We say we don't want Elliot Daly in that England. Again, this is our group chat. Sorry, guys. But in our group chat, we say we never want to see Elliot Daly anywhere near an England team again. But he was just the perfect person to have out there, because that's one thing he is really good at, is chasing after a ball and tapping it back.
Yeah. Well, you think about the players that we talked about. So Dan Cole and Joe Marler, who, I mean, Joe Marler's always been a good scrummager, but is towards the end of his career. Dan Cole is 36, has basically moved from ruck to ruck. But that game on Saturday night was perfect for Dan Cole. He could just stand in the middle of the pitch, watch the kicks flying and everything, and then at the scrum, and then all he would do at scrum time was lock out, and we're fine. And that's what, I'll come on to my point, sort of wider point about Sinclair and Genge in a minute. But it was a great, probably final game for Dan Cole, in that 4 years ago, he got absolutely murdered. And I thought on Saturday, I think it was a nice bit of redemption for him. It's a shame he ended up
losing. He got murdered legally as well.
Yeah. I think it was a nice bit of redemption, or it nearly was perfect redemption, and we nearly won. But some of the other performances that 100% deserved not to be on the losing side was Courtney Laws. Courtney Laws was
on the floor cleaning up dirty ball.
Incredible.
I thought that first half he was man of the match.
Well, I said that, didn't I, in the group chat? I said if he does not deserve to lose, unless he did something stupid to get himself sent off in the second half, he deserved not to be on that losing side, because he was just unbelievable.
Exactly. So Courtney Laws had a great game. Maratoje is probably his best game for 3 years.
As well. Outstanding. He destroyed their line-out.
Totally destroyed the line-out. It was interesting. Their mall, they clearly were going to target us in the mall, and Laws and Atoje, they'd obviously been working on it, and not just them on offhand doing it, the coaching team and the systems they put in place. But they were just ripping apart their mall. I think we turned three over in the mall.
George Martin as well was outstanding.
George Martin had a great game. That felt like the game that's going to cement his place in the side now going forward, alongside Chesham is going to be a mainstay of that side. I thought Alex Mitchell had a great game. You know, he's been up and down this World Cup, but his box kicking was absolutely on point. He was hitting those tram lines every single time. He was putting pressure on those players and allowing our players to get up and tap back and get field position. I think he had one bad kick in the first half or at beginning of the second half, and did a really good job. I'm just sort of looking at the players though. That there's one player, again, I would love to praise, because I thought overall he had a great game, and that was Owen Farrell. But Owen, you know,
did
that
one
drop
thing rather silly, didn't he?
Yeah, the drop goal.
Absolute gobshite.
Yeah, the drop goal was one of the best drop goals I've seen.
As a snap as well.
Absolutely incredible. Brilliant. I mean, it's a shame.
He's not known for that.
And he's not, and well, apart from when he did it against Kings, that was a hell of a drop goal. Put us in a position you thought, and then it all turned. The whole game really turned on the scrum on the South African 5 meters. Again, following a really good bit of play by Owen Farrell, popping the ball into the corner, and we had Carl Sinclair, and I think Genge had just come on at the time, and right, well. I'll come back onto Sinclair again. Just a quick thing. Farrell, I thought, since the Samoa game, which we saw against Fiji, he had a great game. And I thought he had a great game last night. But
he had an okay game against Fiji.
Eh?
He had an okay game against Fiji.
Okay. I thought, okay, fair enough. I thought last night had a great game. But fundamentally, if we're going to pick out why we lost that game, You look at the decision that his ill discipline in that first half cost us big, because it wasn't just one incident, it was two or three incidents, and it eventually led to being marched back 10 meters, which meant that Andre Pollard had a kick, which meant nothing too much at the time, but popped over, and we lost by a point at the end of the day. I'm not saying that Owen Farrell lost us the game. There were lots of factors that led to us losing the game. And
he is a great leader, because you can hear him on that ref mic, how he was organising defence. He was telling our players what to do. You've hit a big hit there, right? Get back in line. Blah, 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 blah. But the leader on that pitch for who should have been captain was Jamie George. Because the way he approached the referee and spoke to the referee,
and the way he grabbed
Farrell and pulled him away, his head was always there in that game.
Yeah, Marla was the same.
But Jamie George is—he's the sort of player who I've always thought he should have been England captain ahead of Farrell for a while. Personally, I don't voice it because.
I think it's really hard for a front rower to be a captain.
Exactly. Though. But then, Sean Fitzpatrick did it for a number of years, played for the All Blacks. So there's no reason why you can't.
Obviously, yeah. I mean, Vic's captain England, didn't he?
Exactly, yeah.
It's just not the easiest position to have regular dialogue.
And the other reason why is that certainly in modern-day rugby is the fact that they normally get the shepherd's crook, don't they, halfway through.
Yeah, you normally are replaced after 60 minutes. Yeah.
But then that doesn't stop South Africa with Khaleesi, and that's what I find quite amazing, that they take him off so early all the time. But that's for a different day. One point I would like to digress and make, and especially having touched on Jamie George, I really would have to be very critical of the selection of the England squad with Theo Dan. Because we have not selected hookers that the coaches have enough. And trust I know him. They selected him, but they didn't have enough trust. Jamie George has played an inordinate amount of rugby. He has played nearly all the Fiji game. He played nearly all the semi-final game.
He played all the semi-final.
He would then have gone and then played all the final, and probably not, unless in the unlikely event we got 20 points clear, he probably wouldn't have come off then. He's played near enough all the rugby there. That man must be absolutely knackered.
One of the big concerns when they selected that squad was that there were players who fundamentally are better scrummagers than Carl Sinclair and Ellis Genge. Now, I would have always picked Ellis Genge because of what he can do around the park. But Carl Sinclair doesn't do a huge amount around the park these days, and he can't scrummage. So what's the point? You don't necessarily win tournaments or games in your scrum, but you can bloody well lose them. And England lost that game because we had a replacement who could not scrummage, and or it couldn't deal with the scrummage that South Africa were bringing. And I just feel that it seems to be that sort of final hangover from Eddie Jones, where we want players to be able to do four or five different things. When actually what you want is you want a player who can do the first thing really well. And if they've got other stuff that they can bring to the game, that's great.
And that might get them into the starting position rather than being on the bench.
But if when you're coming to this sort of level of sport, you need to be able to come onto the pitch. And if your job is to lock out the scrum and to anchor the scrum, that's what you should be doing. Don't get me wrong, the South African scrum is mental. Oxenche is just ridiculous as a scrummaging machine. But you need to be able to do your job. The whole point, and I take the reservations that many people might have about the fact that it's more complicated than just pushing, etc. But we had real concerns about Sinclair and others. Vunipola, for example, Danny Kerr, Ben Youngs, Tuilagi, even Johnny May. And the fact that the depth on the bench wasn't quite there. Now, Loz, I'm going to give you the credit here because you've mentioned this way before about Vunipola and how he wasn't really in any way, you shouldn't be anywhere near this squad.
Are we talking Billy or Mako?
I'm talking about Billy. And I think Loz really called it out a long time ago about Billy. And he really didn't cover himself in glory on the two occasions he was on the pitch on Saturday.
Oh, he was awful. I'm sorry. You don't want a single player. Well, actually, I don't give a shit about single players. That he was bloody dire. He was at fault for them scoring that try. He was just
He'd been on the pitch 2 minutes.
He'd been on the pitch 2 minutes. Lazy. He was walking, and you're just thinking, well, are you on this pitch because you want to win a World Cup? Because I don't care whether it's semi-final, quarter-final, final. At that stage in the tournament, you are on that pitch to win the the trophy, not to win that match. And you're just like, well, what have you got to gain from saving that? Oh, it's okay, because you're going to oh, no, you're not going to do anything later on in the match, because your time was 15 years ago. You're way past it. There are players that offer far more. What's the meat and drinks job of a... Because, Ed, you've mentioned in the past when we've discussed about how a prop has to do... And you mentioned in this pod as well about how a prop should be scrummaging. What's the meat and drink job of a number eight? Well, they got a multi-role, haven't they? They got to carry the ball. They got to tackle. They got to work in the line out. They need to work at the breakdown. Well, can you give me an honest... What is Vunipola? What does he do that stands out above anyone? Someone like, all right, Alex. I'm not going to say Zach Merritt. Alex Donbrand. What does he do that stands out above that?
Yeah, he gives away penalties better.
Oh, what? That's all right, then, isn't it? You know, and you just absolutely despair. He does nothing. Oh, he got written off in the past and come back. Oh, he didn't. He got written off in the past because everyone called him out. Everyone spotted for what he was. And you know, I think he had 1.5 decent games after that. And then how the hell he got selected for this England squad when he was injured in the entire build-up? Because I'll tell you something now. He looked like someone who was carrying a pretty serious injury.
Well, he looked like he was carrying a bit of timber as well. Let's be honest.
Yeah, I was trying to be polite.
No, don't have to be polite. You're right. I mean, the Vunipola one was he was injured, and he then got suspended, and hasn't looked anywhere near his form for a while. We then look at someone like you brought Ben Youngs along in the squad, who hasn't played a lot of rugby at all in this tournament, because they've Borthwick's worked out that he just can't do it anymore. You know, Danny Kerr probably should have been in Eddie Jones's plans in the previous years. Has been called in because of desperation, because we've got no one else.
I know we don't like to talk about Bath, but Ben Spencer's been a quality scrum half for a number of years.
No, and Harry Randall. Harry Randall at Bristol.
I'm not disputing that. I'm just saying that people who are
Ed,
I know exactly what you mean.
I apologise is because we all know there's only a limited amount of changes Borthwick can make.
Yeah, well, the World Cup squad is different.
Stupid.
The World Cup squad is different. You can make as many changes as you want for the World Cup squad. But you're right. Ben Spencer
more ridiculous, doesn't it?
But Ben Spencer agrees.
Players now we can select them for the World Cup.
Yeah, but Ben Spencer, I agree, was a bigger mission. I think he probably should have been closer to the squad. And then we look at Tuilagi and May. I mean, let's be honest, right? Johnny May, I think actually has had a really good World Cup.
Played fantastically at the weekend.
He did, but he's not the best English
game.
Winger
best
at Gloucester.
No, and you look at the people that you could have had on that wing. Would they have been able to do the job that May did on Saturday? That's an interesting question, and we can say that actually...
If you're asking Johnny May to do the job he did at the weekend, every match,
I don't know
he
if
will
England's
carry
got
on
a better
getting
winger
picked.
That.
He will carry on getting picked because he is fantastic at that kick chase, getting up high, tapping the ball back, you know, running those lines, fantastic. But if you want a winger that's really fast
and can break a
line, someone that
can,
doesn't get on with the captain that's really good at that.
Allegedly.
Hey, I was thinking exactly the same person. Yeah. I don't know who that could be.
But you're right there, look, Jim. I mean, this is the thing: is that we love Johnny because he's one of ours, and to be fair to him. He's had an incredible career. He's the second top try scorer in English rugby history as an international. If England had probably played more of an expansive game in the last 4 years, he probably would have beaten Rory Underwood's record. But unfortunately, all he's done for the last 4 years is chase kicks. It's not his fault. That's the style of play that they've played with. It's just a shame that I think you're right there, Jim, Loz, that we could have had somebody who is genuinely exciting. Although probably Saturday wouldn't have been the game for it. Friday, definitely. Give Aaron Dorr go.
We say Saturday wouldn't have been the game for it. I'm not being funny. Just if only we had so many more players we could choose from, you know? Only there was some sort of depth, strength and depth in English rugby.
Yeah,
but
true.
I'm taking the piss. Look,
no.
we were saying about we wanted Johnny May to do that Chase game plan. If we picked a proper decent squad from what was available, I appreciate this is the cherry jam mine rather than elsewhere. But if you'd had the likes of Zach Mercer in the squad, you'd had various other players. Certainly, how's Henry Slade kicking goals for bloody Exeter when there's a World Cup going on? For goodness sake, when even his midfield consists of Bish, Bash, and Bosh.
Well, I know, and it is incredibly frustrating. The players when
Marchant is considered the most skillful of all the players, you know you're in trouble. And I'm not disrespecting Joe Marchant because I think he's actually a really good centre, but you wouldn't be picking, you wouldn't be going, oh, do you know what? Maybe he could do a job at 10 or 12. England should not have been taking on South Africa with that game plan because they should have had enough skillful players to go out there and play them exactly the same way that the Irish played them, beat them by playing some actual rugby as well.
Yeah.
Because England have enough skillful players in their setup outside of this World Cup squad that could have really done a job out there. I'm pretty certain of that.
Yeah, I agree. And I think it really was, the game plan was there to fit the squad rather than the squad was there to fit the game plan, if you know what I mean. I think you're right.
Yeah.
Now on that, we're now in a position where we've gone two cycles, in some cases three, and in some cases, in Courtney Law's, four World Cups, where we've got players who now are at the end of their careers, and or certainly international careers. And I'm going to list names here that are, these are the players who are currently 30 or older. Now, some of these, I think, will probably continue. So these are the players who are 30. So we've got Jamie George, Dan Colt, Joe Marler, Courtney Laws, Billy Vunipola, Danny Kerr, Ben Youngs, Elliot Daly, Manu Tuilagi, Johnny May, Owen Farrell, Carl Sinclair, and George Ford. Now, I would argue probably, if we're looking at the next World Cup, right? Jamie George, I think he's 30, 32.
He's definitely good for the next World Cup.
He's good for the next World Cup. He's pretty bad.
So Dan Cole, Joe Marler, Courtney Laws.
How old's Courtney Laws now?
34.
Oh shit! I was going to say, if he carried on playing like he did on Saturday, then I'd
I think even Courtney Laws has said that was his last dance, which is fair enough.
And I would like to see, you know, rather than players announcing retirement, I would like just to see a proper clear out route. Kind of have a...
Well, no, you're right. I mean, this is the thing. So it's going to be a big job for both of it. But I think in terms of second rows, I'm
we're well blessed.
We're well blessed. Second rows and back rows, we're very well blessed. Let's be honest.
Let's be fair. You would not turn around and question Itoje, Chisholm, or Martin at all as being the three of the four second rows you're going to select in any squad going forward.
You've got other players who are in and around the squad and who are going to come through in the next couple of years that are going to make a big difference. I think we are in an interesting transitional period now with the props and the front row. Obviously, we've got Dan Cole, Joe Marler, and Kyle Sinclair. Now, I think obviously Dan Cole is going to retire. Almost certainly. Even if he's not going to retire, he will be put out to pasture.
Yeah.
Joe Marler, I think, probably realistically is not going to make the next World Cup and it's just not going to be there. Carl Sinclair is the interesting one because although he's probably young enough to play in the next World Cup, I think he's only 30. He's
not good enough.
I don't think he's good enough. Simply put, I don't think he's good enough. I don't think he offers anywhere near enough in the scrummage.
What about Kyle Sinclair?
Carl Sinclair, whatever you want to call him. but no, I do think Kyle Sinclair is...
Kyle Sinclair, how he performed in this World Cup where he wobbled onto the pitch looking like he'd overdone it in the gym or overdone it at the all-you-can-eat buffet, which however you want to look at it, because he went out very rectangular.
Well, Oxenchake says that salad is evil or something, so he only eats cake. So it must work for certain.
Well, yeah, but he, just the way he walked, he didn't look like he could actually physically run the way he moved.
But, I think that's the definite issue with some people that, you know, the gym bunny mentality.
You just look like some guy that, too big, yeah.
Yeah, that you need to... You don't just decide, oh, I'm going to be a prop and get to 130 kilos and be a prop. You kind of, you start off with a bit of natural size, don't you?
It's heft.
Yeah, and I think sometimes if people just, you know, unnaturally put on that mass because they just hit the gym big time, then it doesn't, it doesn't work with the way the body should work, and maybe things like running end up being very difficult.
Yeah, true. And then you sort of move on from Sinclair. I don't. He may have that sort of, you know, thing where he becomes a bit more of a technical scrummager because he can't do the stuff around the bend of the pitch.
If someone could actually get him in proper match fit rather than for doing his actual role of scrummaging and tackling, someone like what Kirill does. You just look at Kirill, he's an absolute unit. I don't mean he's absolutely massive. He isn't, he's just so lean.
Yeah,
he's just so, every single part of his body is shaped to do what he needs to do.
Every single part of his body, Loz?
Oh, yeah. Including that. Apparently, his wife says he's very well shaped to do that job. Now,
just leads on to the other players that we're talking about. So, look, you know, let's be fair, Danny Kerr, Ben Youngs, their international careers are over.
We've expressed our thoughts on Ben Youngs in the past. Yeah.
So their international careers are over. The interesting ones are these, though. I think Johnny May as well. Johnny May has admitted that he's probably going to announce his international retirement after Friday.
He's that the sort of person who's probably going to go before he doesn't get selected again.
Yeah, and I think he's all. But also from a Gloucester point of view, if he says I'm not going to play for England anymore, that's a huge bonus for Gloucester. Massive bonus for Gloucester because we get a really experienced international winger for the next 2 years.
Yeah,
that's huge bonus for Gloucester, and it can only help if he's got, you know, you've got like Jake Morris and some of the other young lads who are coming through. Who better to learn from than someone like Johnny May? It's a massive bonus,
especially when you look at his journey to get where he got to, because he got into the team based on pure talent. Then someone like Eddie came along, turned around and said, "You've got so much to learn to be an international quality winger." He went off to Leicester and supposedly learnt that. And then he made himself a regular fixture in the England team. And now he's come back to Gloucester. So if ever there's a coach turns around and says to one of the Jake Morris, Ollie Thorley, "You need to do this, this, and this," they can go to Johnny May and say, "Right, you know, when you were at that, I've just had this. Can you help?" And he's there for 2 years to be able to help them.
Yeah, exactly. It's a big bonus for Gloucester. The other ones here, we've got Elliot Daly. Now, I think probably not through age, but more the fact that I think there are probably better players that can do his job, which is utility back, really. Now, I think in and around that squad, there are young lads who are coming up, and I think actually could probably do that job. Then you've got Manu Tuilagi, who I just think, again, that's his... He's been going since 2010, 2011. His injuries have been horrendous.
It looked like he was running in custard, didn't it?
Yeah, but then Saturday was not his game, was it? Let's be honest. All he was there for was to try and stop their centres, which he did. But he wasn't going to get any ball. So let's just say that he wasn't going to get any ball, but he helped stop Diolande and Creel.
I would have said that was right up his street, because if the ball came out to him, he didn't have to think about passing it any further. It came any further, he could crash it.
I think he only touched it twice.
Yeah.
And then, so I think he's probably, again, just it's got to that point where I don't think he's going to get a lot left.
Well, I think Lawrence kind of is slightly younger, offers slightly more, but can also do...
Ollie Lawrence, not our Loz, just to clarify for our dear listeners. But yeah, Ollie Lawrence, yes, I agree. Ollie Lawrence seems to be like a Tuilagi Mark II, Jim. Yeah, you're right. Go ahead.
Yeah, and he's not quite as prone to injury.
No.
Potentially. And certainly, a Tuilagi who's even older than he currently is, which is what happens in the future, then, you know, he's going to be even more susceptible to knocks and injuries. So,
Yeah, how long's he got? I say, how long's he got left on the contract with Sale? Can't be very long. He's going to be disappearing off to Japan, isn't he?
You'd imagine that he'd go, yeah, that's your type of player. You think, oh, I might get a year or two in France or a year or two in Japan. I mean, that would be a sensible move for him. The interesting one, though, the last couple of ones, really, the interesting ones for me, which is Owen Farrell and George Ford. George Ford had a year more or less out with injury. Isn't the same combative player as Farrell, and you can imagine will go on for another 4 years, no problem at all, because he's more of a quarterback 10. He directs and moves the ball around. He doesn't go to the line and take it to the line as much. Farrell is more of a combative one. We know about his tackling technique and all the rest of it. Farrell has been very, very robust, hasn't had many injuries. He had one last year, which kept him out from the Six Nations to sort of back end of the season. It's probably biggest danger is suspensions, but do you see Farrell being anywhere near the squad in 4 years' time, or do you think it's actually now a good time to say, look, Owen, you're now the record point scorer?
What is he 30 or 28?
He's 30.
30. So he'd be 34 at the next World Cup.
I think I can't see him being dropped in the next year.
No.
I think he will stay as captain, and he will captain and play throughout the Six Nations and the Autumn Internationals this time next year. And if you're going to do that, then you're almost at the same time going, yeah, unless someone else comes to the fore and really sort of, if Marcus Smith has a fantastic 12 months, for example, and really says, look, I am definitely going to be the England 10 going forward, then maybe in a year's time, you know, Six Nations 2025, you go, that's it for you, Faz. But I can definitely see him being captain for the next 12 months and
part of me wants,
continuing.
Yeah, part of me wants to see him and Ford gone, so it's Marcus's place, because I just want us to build a team around Marcus Smith and play to his strengths. And then England could then turn around and show what they can truly do. But I really don't think that England can afford to lose his experience and leadership, given how many natural retirements are going to happen, because half of that pack, as we have discussed, are going to go. Scrum half, two of the three scrum halves at the World Cup are going to go, because there's nothing to be gained. Even Ben Youngs knows, even, what's he, 32? He's not going to, or 33, he's not going to be at the next World Cup. No way. Danny Kerr made it at 35, and that was a fluke. So he's not going to be at the next World Cup. So to lose someone like Farrell with all his experience, and just as Jim said, another 12 months just guiding through the next generation, maybe a scrum half, it's a negative way, because he shouldn't be anywhere near that team at fly half. Really, if we want to play anything remotely near something what everyone wants to watch. But again, you just can't chuck that experience. As I said to you earlier on, his leadership, you listen to it on that referee's mic, you could hear him organising everything. And
sorry, I should say Farrell's 32.
He's 32.
He'll be 36 in the next World Cup.
Is he 32?
Farrell is 32. I just double checked. So Farrell is 32. George Ford is 30. I have to be honest. I'm looking at this. Yeah, looking at the table here. So Farrell is 32. Johnny's 33. Obviously, you know, Danny Kerr's 36. Ben Youngs is 34. So there's a lot of natural wastage in the nicest possible way here,
yeah,
where players are going to go. But if Farrell's 32, he's 36 at the next World Cup.
Yeah, he's not there for the next World Cup. But
this is the interesting thing. But like Jim said,
but he could be.
That's the thing, though, isn't it? It's really weird. It's unlike football, where we've got the European Championships every 4 years, World Cup every 4 years, and they have a 2 year gap, you know, as people know. Because we have the Six Nations every year, and the Six Nations are, for all intents and purposes, the second most important state, second most important tournament in English rugby after the World Cup. it's very difficult for a coach or for a coaching setup or the RFU to turn around and go, like, right, we're going to use the Six Nations over the next 4 years as a developmental tool. So the next Six Nations, expect it to be fairly raw. There's going to be lots of young players, and we're going to, if we lose four out of the five games, we're okay with that because we're building. That's a very difficult sell. Because
the media won't allow it, will they?
Well, one, the media won't allow it. Two, if you're selling tickets at 90 quid a pop
minimum
to people,
they're the cheap ones.
And they're the cheapest. And you're saying, okay, we want to bring in people to come in. And also the other issue with the RFU you've got is their main revenue source is Twickenham. That's how they make their money. So that's an incredibly difficult thing to do. I would say Farrell, you're almost now relying on the fact that the likes of Farrell, Tuolangi, maybe George Ford, say, do you know what? We fancy a couple of years in France or Japan. That makes the coach's mind up for them. You don't have to really do much then. That's nice. It's a nice, easy break. But you're relying on them rather than having a difficult conversation to Owen Farrell in February or January and saying, look, Faz, you are now the record point scorer, English record point scorer, even more than Johnny Wilkinson now with more points for combined England and Lions. You are now going to be a legend of the game, regardless of whether people in Gloucester like you or not, right? So now is the time to move aside. That's an incredibly difficult conversation to have, particularly when you think that everything has been built around Farrell. It's also an incredibly difficult decision to have when you've got the media backlash. Because if you drop Farrell, that's going to be the main story in English rugby for the whole Six Nations. If Smith has a bad game, why don't we bring Farrell back? And you'd have that for a year, 2 years, potentially, while Farrell might be still playing for Saracens. It's a really,
As you said, if
really
he
could
go off
game.
To somewhere like France or Japan or somewhere where it excludes him from selection.
That would help a lot. So that would be maybe the suggestion.
Or he turns around and says, I've had enough.
Yeah. I get the feeling that he isn't that type of person. I think he would want to stay and fight, which is a really good
admirable.
Really good quality.
It
and
really is
quality
admirable.
Of him.
The only thing I would say is it then does hinder someone of the quality of someone like, say, Finn Smith at Northampton, who he looks like he could be even better than Marcus Smith.
Yeah. I think the problem, of course, is that you know, you're a long time retired, and you've got no obligation to anybody else's career.
Oh, exactly.
You do what you
but
do.
But then we also, it'd be nice to see if that's the case, if Borthwick has got, you know, a pair of plums that can actually make the decisions the difficult decisions that need to be made. I actually think he has. I think he's the sort of person who won't, if ruthless changes need to be made, I think he's the sort of person who will go ahead and do it. He's worked under a number of occasions under Ed Jones. He's seen how it's done.
Yeah.
He's been director of rugby at Leicester. And I don't know why I want to say it, but I thought he made a couple of decisions there which were quite ruthless as well. So I think if his hands aren't tied like they were when he first came into the team with who he could change from what Eddie had because of the agreement with the Premiership rugby teams. If his ability to be able to change that squad is there, I think he might actually go ahead and do it, you know.
Yeah. Well, we'll finish in a second. I just want a couple of things that have come out this weekend with the World Cup and stuff. GM, we'll start off with the, shall we say, interesting revelations around what was said by the South African hooker to Ben Curry, apparently.
Yeah. Some racial slur. No, wasn't it?
Yes. So basically, I can't use the word that the South African hooker used, but he called him a white Charlie uniform November Tango to Ben Curry. Now, Ben Curry then apparently has gone to the referee and says, sir, what do I do when their hooker calls me a white? And the referee said, nothing, please, which I think is probably the best you could give from Ben O'Keefe there. But the what is interesting is there are lots of Afrikaans translations that are being done by some very desperate South African supporters, suggesting that what actually the South African hooker had said was that the ball was at the side. So if you want to Google what that might be, it gives you a rough idea of what he said. So, yeah, so that was the first thing. And then the second thing I was going to mention was, I thought it was really bad, this. So Lawrence Dallaglio, after the final whistle on Saturday, pretty much chucked Ben O'Keefe under the bus, despite what we might think about his refereeing performance, to suggest that South Africa didn't win the game, Ben O'Keefe won it for them, I thought was pretty poor form by old Lawrence.
I don't think the refereeing was particularly one-sided.
No.
I don't think there was a string of poor decisions or incorrect decisions with the benefit of hindsight that you could put together and say that affected the result. It was a tight game. So that it's really, really easy to say, well, that one decision resulted in that, or that one decision resulted in that. But I think if you'd have offered England supporters that scoreline before the game, they'd have probably taken it.
Hmm.
And we like to have a moan at referees when we think they've, maybe not had their best game. But, we're on a little independent podcast. We're not, TV pundits. I think you've got to be a bit classier than that. And I think he's probably let himself down a little bit. But, when it comes to England, my God, the man, has got some passion for England, hasn't he?
Yeah, I
think he's bottled it up quite a lot
with
his TV roles. So, obviously, semi-final, he's just let a little bit out, and I'm sure he'll kind of send some apologies and what have you going forward.
But I mean, the thing about the rugby has always been, it's about an interpretation of the law, and it generally favours the team that's going forward. And regardless of whether we feel that South Africa are scrummaging legally or illegally, South Africa are deemed to be going forward, and both Sinclair and Genge were struggling with that.
Our last front row before we made our substitutions as well.
Now, what I would say is that I have a lot of time for people to go through the decisions that O'Keefe made, and you can always find ones that we disagree with or we agree with or whatever. I totally accept that. I think if it's some random bloke on Twitter saying, O'Keefe got it wrong there, look at this photo, totally fine, I've got no problem with that. I do have a big of a problem when you've got somebody on a national broadcaster in the semi-final, after the semi-final of the World Cup, pretty much the first comment that's made is, it's the ref's fault. I don't think that adheres to what we would like to think of as rugby values.
No,
and I don't think it does anyone any favours. What I would like to hope is in the final that it's probably going to be Wayne Barnes. That seems to be the rumour, that Wayne Barnes is going to get the final, which is good. But it sounds like Luke Pearce will probably be involved in some, because it'll generally probably be an all English reffing team. But what that does mean is you don't get any of the nonsense that I think O'Keefe put up with, which was a lot of back chat from both sides. I think he got a little bit emotional in that first 25, 30 minutes, which is one of the reasons why he got annoyed with Farrell. I think with Barnsley, it's a very straight-laced, this is what's happening, this is what we're dealing with, talk to me like an adult, I'll talk to you like an adult. And it's a very good format to go with. Don't get me wrong, I'm sure whoever loses on Saturday, the equivalent South Africa or New Zealand Twitter will go absolutely apoplectic, and the referee will be blamed. But I'm hoping that it's a good game. It's the second time New Zealand and South Africa have met in a World Cup final. We're all old enough to remember 1995. If it can be as good as that, we're onto a winner. We've not had a really good World Cup final, I don't think, since.
I don't think that was a great World Cup final. That was just one which was close. quality of rugby wise,
it's a different era though as well.
And I know it is.
The game has come on so much. Yeah.
South Africa were just out to negate New Zealand that day because New Zealand was so far ahead of everyone else in the world. Mm. Fair play. What they done was brilliant because they won the World Cup, but
yeah,
they literally, their whole game plan was designed to negate whatever New Zealand had.
Yeah.
And then kick points. And well, I'm hoping we might actually see a bit of rugby in the game.
Yeah, it tends to be World Cup finals tend to be quite close affairs. We haven't really had, I don't think we've really had a good World Cup final since 2003. I think it would be nice to have a good competitive, you know, yeah, exciting that World actually, Cup yeah. final. Do you know actually, what I mean?
I know, because it sounds as an Englishman saying, we haven't had a good Cup final since 2003 when we won.
I mean, France New Zealand in 2011 was very, very close, but it wasn't a great game of rugby. It was very, very error-strewn. You know, 2015 was good for about 20 minutes, and then New Zealand ended up, when Australia started to come back into it, but then New Zealand like ran away at the end. I'd like to see, it would be good to have a good competition, a competitive game. The other thing I'm hoping for is just to see Razzie's face when they lose.
Yeah, they're going to lose bad.
Well, we hope so. It's going to be a very tight game.
I really think the All Blacks are going to do them.
It's an interesting game, and I suppose this is the final bit really, which is your predictions then. So let's start with Friday night. not that we care. England Argentina in the third fourth playoff. Do you think? I mean, I don't really care. It doesn't make any difference. It's not like 1995 where you had to come third. 15. Yeah, I think England quite comfortably personally. Gloucester Saracens Friday night, Jim. What do you reckon your prediction is?
On current form, it should be Gloucester by 20 mm-hmm. because it's Gloucester v Saracens. I'm going to say Gloucester by 3.
I think we'll play a very, very strong side. I think Saracens are going to be probably up for it first 20 minutes to try and prove something, but I think Gloucester will run out quite comfortably winners, probably by a good two scores. And then Saturday, the big one, World Cup final. In with one word, you know, Loz is going to go first on this, and he's allowed
no,
to.
No. You haven't asked my Saracens prediction.
Oh, go on. What's the Saracen prediction then, Loz? Sorry.
Don't know. Okay. No, anyway. I think Gloucester by a. Oh, God. Oh, part of me wants to say, like you did, by 20, but. It's no. Oh,
I said two scores.
Apologies. Let's try it again. Part of me wants to go Gloucester by a load, like Jim was thinking, but because it's Gloucester Saracens, I think it'd be a bit more closer.
Mm-hmm.
Even though we'll be fully loaded. We should. Exeter has set the precedent. We should beat them by 30 or 40. But for me. I know they play, but the similarity with them playing in black compared to the All Blacks is the proverbial there's no such thing as a weak Saracen side, like you always say about the All Blacks, and they will be really smart in having lost the last two. Let's not forget that time when they came and beat us when we were, half-wits were waving the money at them. In the shed,
mm-hmm.
After that controversy, he sent their reserves up and beat us comfortably. So they've got previous to coming to King's Own with their weakened sides and doing the numbers. So I still believe Gloucester will do it, but I think it'll be close.
Okay. Moving on to the Saturday, then the big game, World Cup final. In a word, Loz first. Who's going to win? New Zealand or South Africa?
New Zealand.
Jim, in a word, South Africa, New Zealand.
Black?
You think All Blacks, yeah?
Well, you only gave me one word.
No.
I could have gone new.
You could have been new. New Zealand. You could do New Zealand.
Yeah. New Zealand for me.
Yeah. So, okay. So I think I'm going New Zealand as well. I think they'll probably have just enough.
So then South Africa will win this comfortably then?
Probably, knowing our predictions. What I would say, though, is I think this tournament has been a good thing for rugby. I think the rugby union has been in a tough place, particularly in England over the last couple of years. But I think overall, the World Cup has been a big boon. It's been some fantastic games, some of the best rugby we've ever seen. It's been a great tournament. I think the only letdown is that we didn't get a France or an Ireland or someone like that, or even England in the final, and it would have been a little bit more interesting in the going into the final week. But yeah, it's been a good World Cup. I'm hoping that 4 years time in Australia will get something similar. If not,
I mean, you want Fiji to carry on improving in their 15th so. Game.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And I
Japan, let's not will... hope they drop off from that.
Yeah, we want those tier twos to improve.
Yeah.
And definitely the likes of Portugal, you know, they were a fantastic, you know, fantastic team to have in the tournament. They really brought something. Georgia as well, you know. Mm-hmm. So it's those teams, if they can push on and get a bit better for the next World Cup, then that would be great. And yeah, I think we've got a real, real good chance of having an even greater competition next time round.
It's just in a stupid country. That's the only problem.
It's in a country that doesn't really care about rugby union.
Rugby
anymore.
Union, no, exactly. And it's at stupid times of the day, which is
it is going to make it a little bit awkward.
So worse than Japan, though, isn't it? Fair.
Well, I think it's a little bit worse, isn't it?
Not by much.
A couple of hours, but
it's going to be breakfast fixtures rather than the ones that are good for, you know, the local rugby clubs and pubs to get people in and have a good crowd. So
yeah, I think it's been overall. I mean, look, I think we all had a good time over in France. The rugby was very much secondary, and it was, but it was. I think what I would say is the French did a good job at hosting it, apart from the transport, obviously.
Let's be fair though, can we just point something out as well? We've been very critical of that, but if we'd found the route back to the third game on the first game, we'd been probably talking a completely different story. Infinite wisdom, we followed the queue and followed the crowd all the way to the main stations on the first weekend. The second weekend, where we went over two games, on the first night we decided to walk a few stations down and then try and force our way on one person at a time, which we managed to do. And then on the Sunday night we got on the bus that took us there, and that took us straight back to the railway station, which of course there was no crush because the only people that could get on the train were those that were on the bus, and it worked very quite well actually.
Yeah, lesson learned. But no, but overall, you know, the French, fair play to them. They did it well. I think they got great crowds across the whole tournament. And it's just how you say, just hope the rugby continues to go from strength to strength.
Worst bit about the France having it this World Cup is the fact they don't have the next World Cup, which means we'll not be able to do exactly what we did this World Cup.
Well, we won't have a European World Cup for the next 12 years.
At least.
So, you know, and realistically, it's going to be probably... the rumours are that they're going to try and expand it to either the Iberians, so Portugal, Spain, joint hosting, or possibly Italy is the other one that there's chat about, which I think we can all agree would be absolutely superb. I think 12 years' time is a long time. So that's
why Italy's got the stadium to be able to do it.
They do well. Both of those
they got the infrastructure.
They do have the Spain, Portugal, Italy. They all have the infrastructure. They all have the stadium.
Wouldn't you be put out though if the Iberian Peninsula got it ahead? If you're Italian rugby and the Iberian Peninsula got it ahead of you though,
we got a bid for it though, haven't you?
I know you got a bid for it, but my
and
point
Italy,
being,
Italy didn't. Bid
Italy
for
being
one.
An established tier one nation for.
Yeah,
they're in the Six Nations, mate. That makes them tier
one. True. I mean, I suppose I know what you mean. I mean, there's even the possibility if it's an expanded tournament, you could even have a in all three countries that you do you put the lower tier teams in Spain and Portugal in smaller stadia, and then do the big top teams in Italy. That was something else I read the other day about. You could split it. Personally, I think you're overcomplicating it and you start getting into a FIFA World Cup situation. But, you know, look, 8 years' time, it's America. That's a whole new opportunity for rugby to expand and to grow. Jim is probably looking forward to that one the most. You know, a whole 3 weeks in America, your liver will be thanking you massively.
3 weeks?
What you'd go for, wouldn't you?
8 weeks, isn't it?
No. But I'm saying you'd go for 3 weeks. I mean, if you wanted
to go for eight.
You'd be retired by then, wouldn't you?
I'm doing the whole thing.
You'd be retired by then.
Yeah.
Yeah, it'd be fine.
I'm going to do the whole fucking thing.
Yeah, I don't think I can justify that. I might have to just go for the three. We'll meet up in Pittsburgh, maybe. Fine. Anyway, cool. On that note, thank you very much both for joining me this evening. We've got next week, we'll be talking about, obviously, Gloucester Saracens, the World Cup final. And we'll have a better idea what the hell's going on with this W15, which I did watch a bit of this weekend with England defeating Australia comfortably and France beating New Zealand, which is a bit of a shock.
By a point, isn't it?
By a very point, close yeah. Game. Yeah.
And hopefully my speech will be a bit better because I won't be suffering from man flu and this horrible bad ankle, which has caused me to take a lot of painkillers.
No, I think it's fine, Loz. Don't worry. You're all good. Anyway, on that note, thank you very much both. Have a great week, great week, I should say. And we'll speak again soon.
Cheerio, bye.
Bye.